Okay, we're going to start on Mem Tet Amud Aleph, about 12 lines down in the narrow lines. It's the last word in the line, Rav. Rav Kahana Yohav Le Zuzei Akitna. Rav Kahana received a down payment on flax that he was selling. And of course, the Sofiyakir Akitna, after he had sold it and agreed on a price with someone and received that down payment, the price, the value of the Akitna, the flax, went up. So after coming to Rav, went before Rav and says, Amlei Memai Denikitat Zuzei Havluhu. Rav says to Rav Kahana, you're only obligated to give them the flax at the agreed upon price for the amount up to the down payment. V'idach, and the other part, the varim ninhu, the rest of what you had committed to them was simply a verbal agreement. Udvarim ein behem mishum mechusrei amana, and that when you simply give words, that's not considered a violation of trust if you go back or you change your mind about a verbal commitment that you have made. Now, this psak of Rav really relies on two opinions of Rav. One of them we've seen already, and one of them the Gemara is about to introduce. The one that we've seen already was his machlokes between him and Rav and Rav Yochanan, the previous Amud. It says, Itmar Eravon, when you have Eravon, a down payment, Rav Omar Kenegdohu Koneh. Rav says that you're only responsible, you're only on the hook for Mishapara when it goes up to the amount of the money that was paid in the down payment with regards to Metaltalin. And Rabbi Yochanan Amar Kenegd Kulohu Koneh. Rabbi Yochanan says, no, that once the down payment is made, then you are responsible for the entire amount to uphold your word or to provide the merchandise that you promised at that amount. So here is Rav Lashitato again. Rav Kahana accepted a down payment, and Rav says, Lashitati, you only have to pay up to, or you only have to give them or provide them the merchandise at that price for the amount that they put as the down payment. So that's what Rav told him. Now, with regards to the second issue, which is the issue is even about this part that's above the down payment, Rav Kahana still gave them his word, and he said, listen, we're going to make a deal for 1,000 shekel worth of flax, and I'm going to provide you at this price. So then it comes along, and the price of flax goes up. So Rav says to them, okay, they put 100 shekel down payment, they put a 10% down payment, you're responsible to provide them at that price 100 shekel worth of flax. So that was Rav Lashitato, we saw in the previous Amud. But beyond that, what about the additional 900 shekel? Rav Kahana still gave his word that he was going to give it. Why can Rav Kahana walk away? So that has to do with the second sheet of Rav, which is now in the Gemara, Dimitmar, Devarim. When it comes to verbal commitments or just words, Rav Amar in behen mishum mechusrei amana. That there's no problem. You can walk away from a verbal commitment. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, yesh behen mishum mechusrei amana. Rabbi Yochanan says you cannot walk away. If you make a verbal commitment, you must uphold and stand up for what you committed. Meitave Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda Omer. We have a brisa where Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda says, Ma Talmud Omer. The pasuk says in Parshat Kedushim, there it says, Hin Tzedek, Eifat Tzedek. So there are a number of measurements. The Torah requires an individual to have fair and just measurements. But the Torah gives two types of measurements. It gives a hin and it gives an eifah. And as Rashi points out, that an eifah is 72 lug and a hin is 12 lug. That's 6 times the amount. So if the Torah already mentions that you have to have a just eifah, then obviously you have to also have a just hin, because a hin is a subset or subcategory of eifah. So then why did the Torah mention both eifah and hin? So when it says, Matam Olamar Hin Tzedek, Halo Hin Bichlal Eifahaya. Hin is a subcategory, a subset of Eifah, and it shouldn't have been written. Elo Lomar Lecha, to teach you, Shehei Hin Shelcha Tzedek, that your yes, you should hold and uphold any yes that you give, Balav Shelcha Tzedek. And any no that you give, you also have to uphold your word, meaning that you have a commitment to carry out what you verbally agree to do. Now, a person makes verbal agreements or makes verbal commitments, and they have to carry them out. They have to stand by their word. Samar Abaye, so what's Rav going to do with this? This limud of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, the pasuk. So Abaye says, no, that's not the way to explain it. Abaye says, Hau shelo yedaber achad bepeh v'achad b'lev. That's different. That is, a person may not lie about what they're really feeling or trick somebody in the words that they say. I mean, they may not say something that they don't really believe or is not true in their heart. So that difference will be, according to Rabbi Yochanan, if you give a commitment and you make a verbal commitment, you have to stand by it. And the Rav says, listen, circumstances change, context change. If circumstances change and the context change and you change your mind, that's not considered not upholding your word, that's considered changing your mind. On the other hand, if at the time that you made the verbal commitment or the time that you gave your word, you knew for certain you weren't going to keep it because you're really covering up for what you really knew, that is considered mechusrei amana, because then you're tricking the individual, you are lying to the individual in the sense that you are telling something that you don't plan on carrying out. But this individual, when he made the commitment and when he made the verbal commitment, he only intended to carry out his commitment. Only later on, situation changed and he didn't want to do it. So now, to the... we have an additional question. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Shimon says, "Avapi shamru talit kone dinar zahav." Even though we have the principle that a talit can acquire a dinar zahav, why? Because talit is considered peirot, and a dinar zahav is classified as currency here, and you can do a kinyan chalipin on the talit to acquire the coin. Zahav, that is true. Vein dinar zahav kone talit. On the other hand, you can't do it the opposite way around, because ein right, matbea nase chalipin, a matbea, the currency, can't be used as the chalipin. So since you can't use it as chalipin, you can't acquire the talit. If you take possession of the dinar zahav, that does not give you possession of the talit. Mikomakom. Even though such a kinyan does not function because the kinyan chalipin is not here, right? Kach halacha, this is the halacha, aval amru. If that's the, even though this is the halacha, and mi'ikar adin, you have no responsibility to uphold the transaction or to keep to your commitment. Nevertheless, aval amru, misha para manshei dar urmabu, or manshei dor hapilaga, hu atili para mishen omeid bidiburo. So we still have misha para, that a person is cursed if they have made a commitment, and they don't stand by that commitment, then we say, even though there's no kinyan, which makes it a formal halachic obligation, nevertheless, there's still a responsibility to carry out the commitment that you made. I says that is actually subject to machloket tanaim, whether there's a concept of mishapara in these instances. That's not. Maseh Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew. The case of Yochanan Yatu, Shamar Livno, said to his son, "Save us cholanu po'alim. Go out and hire workers for us." Halach, upasak lahem mizonot. So his son went out and agreed to hire the workers. Plus, he said, committed to them that he'll provide meals for them. When he came to his father, even if you make for them the biggest suda in the world, meaning that, like that of Shlomo HaMelech in his time, lo yatzati de chovat chayim ahem. You may not have discharged your obligation to provide them mizonot. Shehem b'nei Avram, Yitzchak v'Yaakov. Meaning that Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew has this view of a fellow Jew being holding him in the light or in the standard. We're saying that this person is a prince. He's a b'nei melachim, Jews, any other Jew. And if that's the case, and you just committed to give them food without any quantification of what you're committed to them, then they're really, truthfully, that we have an endless obligation to keep providing from them, because we never have discharged our obligation. There is no end to our obligation. Ella, so he says back to his son, Ella, actually, yatchilu b'malacha, before they start working, save them more than him, go and tell them, I'm not shein lechem alai, ella pat v'knit belat. Go and quantify for them exactly what the suda is that we're going to commit, or that we're going to give to them. That way, we can discharge our obligation. We'll provide them what we say, and then we'll be done with what we offer to do for them. Where it says, if you think that if a person makes a verbal commitment, they're not allowed to go back on the verbal commitment, how did he go say to his son, go back and reverse the transaction with these individuals? Why is he saying go back to the polyam and say to them, listen, I'm sorry, but even though I said suda, I want to come back and I want to tell you what the suda is. Now, I would have answered now at this point that he's not really going back on his word. He's just defining, or he's giving a more quantified and exact definition of what he meant by mizonot. Now, obviously, the Gemara did not feel this way. Gemara gives a different answer, and must be because when the son said this, he may not have believed that, or he may not have thought that he was going to quantify it. He just said, give him a great suda. So there, Gemara says, shiny hatam, the polim gufayu lo sam chidatayu. It's true that the polim themselves did not think that this commitment by the son was final. Why? My time up. Because they know that the son was an agent of the father, and they know that the son's word is not final. It's the father's word that's final. So until the son goes back and checks with the father, the Paulim don't believe that the deal is done. They don't listen to whatever he committed to and say, okay, well, for sure, that's what we believe. No, they say, listen, we could change, he could change his mind when he goes back to his father. So, if that's the case, that it's also Mechan's father, why, once they started working, why can't they, he also changed their mind then? Why did Yochanan say to his son, go change the commitment before they start working? Why can't he change it after they started working? I mean, if the whole premise of the reason that they're allowed to change over here is because the commitment of the son is not considered a full proof or a full commitment, then that should be true even when they start working. Once they start working, they assume that the father knows, and that they believe that whatever was committed to them will be paid. Because until the time that they're working, they say, all right, the son will go back to the father, they'll check it out, maybe he'll come back with some response or some change in the terms. But if he already allowed us to start working, that means that the father already gave his acquiescence, he approved whatever the son did, and therefore they are sumech dat. So Amro Meimar Amar Kamidavua, he already checked this out with his father, cleared it with his father, and he's happy with it. So now, based on this, What we have is a Gemara that's saying that Dvarim, right, this idea of verbal commitment happens to be subject to a Machloket Tanaim, because some Tana, the Tana which we saw before, which is Rabbi Shimon, says that there is a Mishapara on someone who backs out of a transaction, even though there's no Halachic Kinyan that is here. On the other hand, right, we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew saying that to his son that he can go and reverse the commitment. Christ says that's no proof that you can back out of your word, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew is a unique situation. That unique situation is that his son is really acting as an agent of father, but not really empowered to make final commitments. So the Poalim who agree with him know that they could be subject to change because he has to go back and clear it with his father. Another thing I would also point out is that the Gemara already on the previous daf mentioned to us that the, when it comes to Mishapara, Mishapara is limited with Dvarim, V'ikuba Dayu Ma'ot, Kayiba Aval. That the Mishapara only subjects, or people only subject to Mishapara when they make a verbal commitment, plus there is a Kinyan Ma'ot. Even though Kinyan Ma'ot, the Chamim, were Mafkia, that Kinyan, still it has some sort of formalization of the transaction, not enough to make it enforceable and based in, but still enough to get a Mishapara. Yet Dvarim, by themselves, when you have a kinyan, if you have a commitment, a verbal commitment without anything else, the Gemara says no mishapara. So what you have to say over here for Rabbi Shimon, the reason the Gemara is bringing this as a proof here, is because Rabbi Shimon's case is a case where there's only dvarim. Because had it been that the case where Rabbi Shimon was also dvarim plus a kinyan, then you could explain Rabbi Shimon's position and not be a question on Rav. Rav who says Dvarim are not an issue, and then all of a sudden Rabbi Shimon saying yes, Dvarim are an issue, and you have Mishapara. Well, you could just answer that Rabbi Shimon is like what we explained in the previous daf, that only when there's a formal kinyan, even though the kinyan is not effective enough to make it enforceable and based, nevertheless that formalizes the verbal commitment enough to make you Chayav and Mishapara. So over here, we have to look, is there enough of a kinyan? So the kinyan that he tried to effect was a kinyan of Chalipin. He tried to take the gold coin to effect a kinyan on the talit. Now the kinyan Chalipin fails here because it's not a kinyan ma'ot. What we said in the previous daf is you have to have a proper kinyan, but a proper kinyan that just doesn't work in this situation. So there you have ma'ot. It really should work, but a chamim mafkiyat. So there they say that is enough to create the strength of the dvarim and make a commitment. Over here, Rabbi Shimon says something further, a step further. Rabbi Shimon says that even though there's a tried to do a kinyan chalipin, the kinyan chalipin fails. There's nothing. It's as if there is no kinyan here whatsoever. And despite that fact, Rabbi Shimon says there's still mishapara. So that's the proof from Rabbi Shimon. Even though it's simply just dvarim, Rabbi Shimon believes you get mishapara. So that would be a proof to Rabbi Yochanan and a problem for Rav. So again, we tried to solve that problem by saying that Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew has the position, the opposite of Rabbi Shimon, says that verbal commitments can be reversed. The Gemara says that's not necessarily the case, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Yatu might have been a unique case. Now the Gemara says, but Rabbi Yochanan himself, Umi Amar Rabbi Yochanan Hachi. The Rabbi Yochanan really say such a thing. V'amar Rabba Babarchanam Rabbi Yochanan. Omer lechaviro, matana ani noten lecha. Person says to his friend, I have a gift for you that I'm going to give to you. Yacholach zorbo. Person can reverse it. He can decide not to do it. Rezes pshita. Of course he can reverse it. He's the one giving the gift. Or else he doesn't have to give the gift. Ella mutar lach zorbo. Not only can he reverse it, but he is permitted to reverse it and not give the gift. So Amar Papa, Rabbi Sosa says, Umoda Rabbi Yochanan Manatam Etet the Samcha Datayu. Rabbi Papa says it qualifies the statement of Rabbi Yochanan that there are no so such thing as a gift, and that a verbal commitment to give a gift is not final, and you can back out of it, it's mutar to back out of it. That is only true when it's a large gift. But a small gift, something that's considered to be minor form of gift, in that case you may not reverse your position, you are obligated to give it. Why? Because in a small gift, the recipient is Sumechdat. He believes that you're really going to give it. Because it's small, he says, what's the big deal? He's going to give it. He says he's going to do something. He commits to give something. If it's not such a big item, then he assumes that you're actually going to do it. On the other hand, if it's a large gift, he says, you know, maybe he will, maybe he won't. There's a good chance to reverse it. Can I really trust him in this? So the fact that he doesn't really believe it's going to happen, he's not certain it will happen, then that's not enough of a commitment. That verbal commitment, one can walk away from. So this is logical to explain Rabbi Yochanan in this instance. Israel, Shamar ben Levi. So Israel says to a Levi, ben Levi is just used as a term, a general term for a Levi. Kor maaser yesh lecha biyadi. So Israel has some maaser rishon to give away, and he says to Levi, listen, I have a kor of maaser. last there in my house, my Sirishan, I want to give it to you. You can have it. So Ben Levi Rashai, this Levi is permitted now to asut to Trumat Maser Makom Acher. Say, the Levi himself has 99 other Kurim of Maser Rishon. Now, the Levi is required to give 10%. Maser Min Maser is to give 10% of his Maser Rishon to the Kohen. That's called Trumat Maser. So over here, if he has 99 Kurim, plus the Kur with his other individual, he has now 100 Kurim, he has to give one Kur to the Kohen. So he says, you know what, I have the 99 here, I have the one over there, the one that this year says we get to me, I'm making that into Trumat Maser. So that he's allowed to do. So Gemara says, okay. Iamart. So Ben Levi Rashi asut to Trumat Maser on Makom Acher. You can make this Kur into a Trumat Maser. So Gemara says, Iamart, Bishlam Alo Matzin Lamahadar Bey. If you say that he can't reverse his position, Mishum Hochi Rashi. That makes sense. If the Yisrael, once he's committed the verbal commitment to the Levi that he can't reverse his position, then it makes sense that he can use that as Trumat Maser and he can be Somich on that gift to make it into Trumat Maser. Iamart Matzin Lamahadar Bey. If you think that the Baal Bayit can pull the plug on the Levi and say, listen, you know, I'm not going to give it to you anymore, then am I Rashi? Well, how could you give him permission to use that for Trumat Maser? That means if he was somich on this barrel, to this kur, to be the Trumat Maser, and it turns out that the Yisrael gave it away to another friend, then Levi's up a creek. He's now eating Maser Rishon that doesn't have Trumat Maser removed from it. He's eating Tevil. So it must be that once the individual commits to give it to him, that we can assume it's going to be given and the position won't be reversed. So now Gemara says, based on that, we can explain Rabbi Yochanan's position. Rabbi Yochanan believes that when it's a large gift, then a person's not so mechdat, and in large gifts, he's not so mechdat. That is why Rabbi Yochanan says that you can reverse or you can walk away from the transaction. On the other hand, right, Rabbi Yochanan says when it's a small gift, when it's a small item, in that case, the recipient is so mechdat, he believes you're going to give it to him, and he might even act on that, or he might expect it, and since he expects it, then you may not walk away. Your verbal commitment is enough to obligate you to give the gift. And the proof, the Gemara says, is from the case of Ben Levi. Because by Ben Levi, what does the Yisrael really own? The Maaser Rishon belongs to Shevet Levi. It doesn't belong to this Yisrael. It's actually Mamon of the Shevet, Mamon of Shevet Levi. On the other hand, right, even though it's Mamon Shevet Levi, the Yisrael is entitled to choose which Levi he gives it to. That is what we call Tova Tana. That Tova Tana is a machlokas in the Gemara, whether that even is a tangible monetary value or is it simply intangible, but nevertheless, it's a very small amount of money. So what the Yisrael really has to gift, meaning what he's giving, is something small. His ability to gift it to a particular Levi is a very small gift. That small gift, right, is what Rabbi Yochanan says is a commitment, and that's what the Gemara is proving from here. From Ben Levi, the fact that the Ben Levi can reap somechanis and the Yisrael cannot reverse his position, that's because the Yisrael is giving a very small gift. And giving a small gift, he can't back out of it because the Levi is somechdat. Now, the Gemara is somewhat problematic over here, although Rashi and the Gemara seem to read that that is the situation. It's clear that the Gemara believes that the smicha dadat comes from the recipient side, not from the giver's side. That the smicha dadat is really dependent on the recipient saying that it's a small item, so therefore give it to me. So despite the fact that the Yisrael only has tovatana here, he only has the ability to give away his value in this Maaser Rishon is small, nevertheless, to the recipient, to the Levi, it's a large gift. This Maaser Rishon happens to be a very large amount of Maaser Rishon that he's given. It's a full kur. And so to him, it's a big gift. So maybe, right, you have to say that the way the Gemara is looking at it is that the Levi also just sees this as a small gift because that's all the Yisrael is entitled to. Although in reality, it seems that the Levi is getting a large gift, even though the Yisrael doesn't, in a sense, own it, he's still getting a large gift. And that gift to the Levi, maybe it wouldn't be so mechdat. It's clear that the Gemara does not learn that way, although it seems somewhat logical to have said that it's really based on the recipient and not on the giver. But over here, the Gemara is extending, or the way Rashi is learning, you have to say that because the giver is ownership in this Maaser Rishon is small, therefore the recipient also looks at the gift as being a small gift. Now, the Gemara says, okay, we don't have to say that. Who says that that's the explanation? How come I skin it? No, we can explain this case of the Ben Levi differently. Kugon, should not be in the middle. The Yisrael actually gave the Maaser Rishon to the Levi, and then and then the Levi gave it back to the Yisrael to watch for him. Where it says, then what are you going to do with the rest of this brisa? Alright, great. You explained the first half of the brisa, and that brisa is no longer proof to Rabbi Yochanan between a difference between small gifts and big gifts. Nevertheless, what are you going to do with the second part of this brisa? It says, not know the Ben Levi Acher. What happens if the Jew, even though he's not mutar to do this, he goes and reverses his position and hands it to another Levi? He can complain. He can whine and complain, but that's all he has. He doesn't have a din against this Yisrael, this Levi who thought he was getting this Maaser Cerrito has no recourse. He has nothing that's enforceable in Beis Din. He can just complain about it. If that's the case, how could that be? If you think that the Yisrael already gave it to the Levi, that means that it became the Levi's money. And then when the Levi gave it back to the Yisrael to watch, what do you mean? Why does he only have complaints? He has a monetary claim against the Yisrael now because he gave it to him to watch for him. As soon as the Levi took possession of the Meiser Rishon, since he made a kinyan on it, it's his. Must be below not low. Shmamina. Has to be the case here is a case where he didn't take it yet. And when he didn't take it yet, there's a commitment because the Yisrael said he's going to give it as a gift, and since it's a small gift, that is a commitment that you cannot back out of. That's what Gemara says. Mishnah Brisa says that you cannot back out of that commitment. It's not mutar lachzorbo. You have to keep your word. Now, in the end, if the person goes ahead and backs out of it, there is no kinyan here. There is a failure of kinyan. If there's a failure of kinyan, then we can't enforce it in Beis Din. But nevertheless, the proper thing to do in this instance is to follow through with your gift. Just as an interesting sidebar, in American law, there is a similar type of concept, which is detrimental reliance. American law has conceptually has two courts. It's the court of law, which carries out things under the law, and there's a court of equity. A court of equity is where we try to, even though something under the law is not enforceable, but we think to make things equitable, we say that it makes sense that we'll enforce something despite the fact that the law is not that way. One of those cases is gifts. If someone commits to give a gift to another individual, then there's two different ways to look at the gift. Now the person comes to court and says, listen, this guy committed to give me a gift. I want to enforce it. I want the court to give it to me. The court says, I'm sorry, it's too bad. We don't do that. But there is an instance when the court will enforce this case. What's the instance where the court will enforce this case? That's the case when there's what's called detrimental reliance. If the person, after hearing that they received this gift, went and acted upon it, they acted upon the gift and did something premised on the gift, if it's a reasonable assumption that he would get the gift, then the court will enforce it and insist that he pays the gift. So, for instance, if someone commits to give $5,000 to an individual or 5,000 shekel to an individual, and then the individual goes and buys a car based on that, he says, oh, I have a down payment and I'll use the rest of the money to pay off and I'll buy a car with it. So now, since it was reasonable for this person to believe that he would get such a gift, and then he went and acted upon it, the court will enforce that type of gift and say you must give the gift. On the other hand, if the individual says, I'm going to give you $1 million, right, then he goes out and buys a house based on that we would not consider the reasonable reliance on the word of the individual. People don't just give gifts of $1 million just like that. So now, based on that, it's similar to what the Gemara just discussed over here. The way the American court, the American law looks at it is detrimental reliance is that when do we assume an individual really believes they're going to get the gift. So there are ways. The one is he has to be reasonable, and number two is he has to act on it. If he acts on it, he demonstrates that he really believes he's going to get the gift. And in that case, the court will enforce it. In the other case, where he didn't act upon it yet, then we say, yes, he said he's going to give you a gift, but you didn't act upon it, so that doesn't show real reliance on the fact that you're receiving the gift. You thought you were going to get the gift, but you had some doubts because you didn't really act upon it. Very similar to the conclusion of our Gemara about Samcha Datayo, the recipients, about how the recipient feels about the gift will determine the obligation of the individual to give the gift. Right now, the next case in the Gemara, Gavra, Dehavu Yezuze Yashum Shemei, is an individual who paid money for sesame seeds. The Sophie Akar Shum Shemei, of course, the price of sesame went up. Hajrabu. So the sellers, the merchants who were selling the sesame seeds, says, we're not going to sell you anymore. We don't have any more sesame. We're out of sesame seeds now because price is up, but we're not selling it to you at that old price that we committed to. Shakul Zuzeh, they say, take your money because, you know, we're not doing the transaction. Lo Shakul Zuzeh, he refused to take his money. In the end, Ignov, the money was stolen. Atakamidarov, they came before Rav Amalei. Karen Damar Lacha Shakul Zuzeh, since they said to you, the merchant said to you, take your money, Velo Shaklit, and you didn't take it. Lomi bai the shomer sacher d'lahavi. He's not even a shomer sacher here. Ela filo shomer chinam nami havi. He has no obligation towards you. He handed your money back. If he handed your money back, then you have to take it. If you decide to leave it there, he never made a commitment to watch the money when you leave it there. That's your problem that you left it there, and therefore he's not responsible for anything. Some of the rabbanon and the rav, they said to rav, v'habay l'kubalei le'mi shapara. Wait a minute. This individual, these merchants had made a commitment to this individual to sell something at a price, and he made a down payment. If he makes a down payment, right, then we have what's called mishapara. Mishapara is that he's going to get a curse. He's going to have to accept the curse of mishapara if he doesn't fulfill his commitment. So you're right. And Ochanami, he has two choices here. You're right. Either he provides the merchandise, either he provides the sesame seeds like he committed to do, or he has to take Misha Parah. Then he's going to have to accept the Misha Parah because he did violate the agreement that they had, an agreement that had a down payment with it. An agreement without a down payment, you can't walk away from without being Mekabel Misha Parah. So now, this is the claim, or these are what was told over as to be the case, or the situation, and the psak of Rava. What the Gemara is going to do now is tell over from other Amoraim that this case never took place, and that the information and the facts were misrepresented over here. So Amar Rav, Amar Li Ravina. The Prophet says that Ravina told me, the Didi Amar Li, Haumi Rabbanan, one of the Rabbanan told me, Rav Tvut Shmei, Ramila Rav Shmo Bazut Shmei, one of these two Amoraim said to me, Diabu Yavile Kochalla Doma, Lohabi Vashani Bidubre, if you gave me the whole world, I would never change my mind. I would not back out of my word. Meaning that this individual was involved in this case, and he said he would never not keep a verbal commitment, no matter what. So that is not the situation. Bididi have uvda. He says, the case was with me, and now let me tell you the real facts. That day was Erev Shabbos Kodesh. I was sitting in my house. I was there. I see this individual standing at my doorway. He says, do you have sesame seeds to sell? I'm really low. I said to him, I don't have any more. I'm sold out. Shabbos is here, I'm sold out. This individual with the who brought money to buy the Shemshay says, you know what, I'm leaving this money for you to watch. Because I'm not going to make it back home before Shabbos, and so I need to leave my money with you before Shabbos comes in. So the individual, this Amora, whichever one of the two Amoraim it was before, either Rav Tavut or Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra, one of these Amoraim said back to this individual, my house is open. Then Otvinu Bebeta, he left him in the house of Ignov, and then they were stolen. So now Atu Bekami Derava, they came to Rava for Pesach Alocha. Amalei Kol Ha Beta Kamach Lo Mi Bai Shomer Sachar Zolahavi Ela Fil Shomer Chinam Lam Lehavi. So Rava's Pesach, the one that we had just seen before, was not about the case where it was a down payment, rather about this case. What's unique about this case? It says anybody who says Ha Beta Kamach, anybody who comes along and says that my house is open to you, is making no commitment to watch the money. He's saying, do what you want to do. He's not saying, yes, I will watch the money for you. It's just saying, you do make your own choices. So if you put the money there, that's your own choice. I'm taking no obligation to watch it. So that's what it means, Habeta Kamach. Tosus points out, we did have the Gemara in Bava Kamma. We discussed when a person gives over an animal for Shmirah, what is the status of that animal? Right? If you ichnis b'shut balachatzer, chayav. Rabbi Marchik balalev balachatzer Shmirah. We had a machlokes between the Chachamim, Rabbi, and Rabbi. The Chachamim believed that once you give it over, if you know, if the Baal knows and is aware of the fact that you left something in his property, then you're responsible for it. Rabbi says, no, you have to explicitly state that I'm accepting the Shmirah over the animal. So what is the case here? The case here sounds like also you have to explicitly state, I'm watching the animal for you. So therefore, who we passing like? We're passing like Rabbi, it sounds like. And that's what Tosa says. Tosa says that over there, that is Machlokas Rav and Shmuel. And Rav was paskin like the Tanakama, and Shmuel paskined like Rabbi, and since in Dine Mamonos, we paskin like Shmuel, so therefore the din is like Rabbi. If the din is like Rabbi, that means that you're not committed to be a Shomer until you explicitly state it. This gives a second answer, which says that even according to Chachamim, it could work over here. Why? Because it's different. So over here, in the case in Baba Kama, he says, Kano Shorcha. All right, when you come in and you say, I'm going to leave it with you, and he says, all right, bring it in, that is a commitment to watch it. But in this case, Habeta Kamach, when you say, my house is open, you're not making any commitment to bring it in. You're just saying, do what you want. So Tosa says, maybe there's a difference in Lashon. Over there, when you say, you know, bring your shore in, that's already more of a commitment to watch the animal. Over here, when you say, my house is open, you didn't say, bring the money in. You said, my house is open. That is not a commitment to watch it in this instance. So now, the Gemara is, V'amrlei, I said back to Rapapi, this is Ravina, when I said back to Rapapi, V'amrlei Rabban on the Rava, Yibaylei Lukulelei Mishapara. Right, or Ravina said back to the Amora, who's telling the story that we heard said that Rava, afterwards, the Chamim said to Rava, he has to be Mekabel Mishapara. And in our case, there's no such thing as Misha Parah. In a case where you have a transaction, like the first explanation of the case in Rabbi's Psak, there's a transaction, and then there's something to talk about Misha Parah. Over here, when we're talking about a Shomer, the Shomer has no relevance with Misha Parah. That's a transactional issue, not a Shmira issue. So he answered back to him. He says, by the way, Misha Marli, lo yudvrin olam. That was never part of the case. That part of the case where it was added on afterwards, that is not that. So the other information that you had was true, despite the fact that the psak of Rava is true, and what Rava said is true, is just about a different case than you thought. Now the last piece where they told about the information Mishapara, that part was not even a part of the case. That's a part of what anybody said to Rava, and that's not relevant to our case at all. Now the Gemara continues. So this is from our Mishnah. And our Mishnah says, Rabbi Shimon says that whoever has the money in his hand, he is the upper hand. So that's basically the mocher, the seller. The seller, once he receives the money from the lokeach, he has the upper hand because he has both the merchandise and the money. He has merchandise and the money. Rabbi Shimon says he has the ability to reverse his position or to back out of the transaction. But the lokeach, but the buyer does not. Tanya, I'm a Rabbi Shimon. Brisa, Rabbi Shimon says, "Ematai, when is this true? Bezmashra kesef veperot biyad mocher. When the money and the merchandise in the hands of the mocher. Al kesef biyad mocher, uperot biyad lokeach, and yachod akzerbo. If the money is in the hands of the mocher and the perot are in the hands of the buyer, then he can't go back on it. Bipnei shekaspo biyado. Meaning, because he has the money in his hands. Rabbi says, what do you mean biyado? Lokeach doesn't have the money, it's biyad mocheru. It's with the hands of the mocher. No, because he's gotten the equivalent of his money. He's gotten the merchandise already. Since he's gotten the merchandise already, he can't reverse it. I mean, now the buyer has the merchandise and the seller has the money. So now the transaction's complete. So I says, Pshita, what else would you think? Meaning that, of course, the transaction's done. He made a kinyan mashiach on the merchandise. The seller has the money. Why should he be able to reverse the transaction? Now we have a full and complete transaction. It doesn't make sense that he can reverse the transaction. So I'm a rabbi of my skin. What's the case here? Now the case here is a unique case. The case is that the buyer owns a house and he owns a second floor in his house. And he rents out the second floor in his house to the mocher, to the seller. So now, time amai, takin rabbanan mishicha. Why did the rabbanan, why did they institute the mishicha, kinyan mishicha, in the face of ma'ot? Right, we say that ma'ot konot min haTorah, according to Rabbi Yochanan. And nevertheless, we say the chamim mafkia that kinyan and say, no, you still need a kinyan mishicha. Why did they say that? Gezer Hashem yomar lo nisfru chitecha baliyah. We're afraid that the merchandise will still be in the possession of the mocher, despite the fact that the transaction is done because lokech, the buyer, gave the money. And if something detrimental is to happen to this produce, if a fire comes or something happens, the mocher is not going to be interested in taking care of it. Why is he not interested in taking care of it? Because it's not his stuff anymore. Since it's not his stuff, he says, you know, hasta la vista, I don't need to deal with this. So we say to him, no, I'm sorry. This transaction could be null and void. Since this transaction could be null and void, therefore we're going to obligate you in this instance to, or it's going to force you to deal with the merchandise that's still with you, because the transaction is not complete until the lokeach takes possession of it. Where it says, hacha b'shuta lokeach ninu. In this instance, the property, the merchandise, is really with the lokeach. Why? Not from its side of a kinyan that it's in the lokeach's property, because the property is rented out to the mocher, to the seller, and it doesn't belong to the lokeach anymore. But he's in the same house. If we're afraid that there's going to be a fire or some dramatic natural event's going to happen and it's going to damage the merchandise that's upstairs, and the mocher is just going to ignore it. But right here, the lokeach lives right under him. He knows what's going up. If he knows there's a fire there, he's going to run up and get his stuff. If he knows there's a flood coming or something detrimental that's going to happen, he's going to go up and take care of it. Right? So lokeach, because over here, hachav b'shuta lokeach nu, even a flood, the lake of bonis, if some sort of fire all stunts by accident, he will tell chamaitala, the lokeach will go up and get it, because he knows that his stuff is upstairs, and he knows there's a fire. So therefore, the issue, or what's happening here, the reason that it's not applicable, the Takanat Chachamim is not applicable in this case, is because it's a unique set of circumstances. The unique set of circumstances, then the buyer has no reason, or we have no reason to be attacking on behalf of the buyer this protection that the Ma'ot are not Konot. So in this case, the Ma'ot are Konot because there's no reason for the Gzeirah. In a normal case, the ma'ot are not konot, and therefore the takanat chachamim, that the transaction is still reversible even after the money is given, because that will put the mocher on notice or on warning that he's got to take care of this merchandise until it reaches the hands of lokeach. This individual put a down payment of money on wine. And in the end, he heard that there was a big wedding to be held. The Mishnah Lamelech, the princes, one of the assistant to the king, the second of the king, his name was the Beit Parzak, was going to get married. Now, when the second of the king gets married, they want to have a big party. So you think he's going to pay for the big party? No. They go around town and they confiscate all the wine from everybody. Anybody has wine, then they bring it to the Beit Simcha. That's how they provide the food for the celebration. So this individual says, oh my gosh, I just put a down payment on this wine. I don't want to can wine. Until this wedding's over, I don't want to have any wine in my possession. So he goes back and he says, listen, I want my money back. I really don't want the wine now. So Atul came into Rav Chista. They went to Rav Chista and said, wait a minute, you know, he committed to put a down payment. He wanted the wine, and it should be done. He should have to take the wine here. So Atul came into Rav Chista and said, kaderach shetiknu mishicha b'machrin, kak tiknu mishicha b'lekukot. Now this is actually a two-way street. That's what Rav Chista says. It's a two-way street. When the chachamim were mafkia akinyan ma'ot, so over here you have ma'ot, money that was handed by the lokeach to mocher, mina Torah according to Rabbi Yochanan, that should be a final transaction. And Rav Chista is holding like Rabbi Yochanan that the transaction is finalized when the ma'ot is given mina Torah, except the chachamim were mafkia the kinyan ma'ot in order to protect the lokeach, to protect the buyer. So when they protected the buyer, they're really the only person they need to be able to reverse the transaction is the mocher, is the seller. Because if the seller can back out of the transaction, then he will remember, or he will be committed to take care of the merchandise until it reaches the hands of the lokeach. Now, Rabbi Tam again explained, we saw this on the previous daft, that Rabbi Tam explains that in a case where they are actually burnt up, the lokeach has a right to walk over there also. But in a normal case, the chachamim's takana was only that the mocher could back out, because that's all we're trying to protect the lokeach. The fact that the lokeach can back out, that's not necessary in a normal transaction. Rabbi Chista says no. That once the chachamim gave rights to the mocher, they gave those same rights to the lokeach. And just like the mocher, that a kinyan ma'ot does not lock him in until there's a mishicha, so too by the lokeach, by the buyer. Until there's a kinyan mishicha, the buyer is not locked in, and he can back out of the transaction. Now, true, he can back out of the transaction, he might be subject to mishapara, he might be subject to in ruach chachamim nochemenu, but despite that fact, he still, right, is not obligated min adin to carry out the transaction. Just like the mocher is not obligated, so too the lokeach is not obligated. Right, now we'll start this mishnah on, and then we'll continue the rest of that sugya tomorrow. The mishnah says, ona, arba kesef mesim v'arba kesef. That ona, ona is the overcharging for merchandise. In the overcharging for merchandise, how much is classified as being ona? What is it considered to be ona? So the Tanakhama believes it is 4 kesef out of 24. 4 out of 24 is 1/6, which is shtut mekach. 1/6 of the merchandise, 1/6 of this sale item. If the price exceeds 1/6 of that item, or it's less than 1/6 of that item, meaning it's underpaid, the mocher was cheated out, or the lokech was cheated out, either way, that is classified as ona. How much time does the individual have to return the item? Because the lokeach buys it, and then he goes and finds out that he overpaid for it. How much time does he have to give it back? Until he can show it to an expert, a merchant, or to his relative, that would be the time that he has, is allotted to him in order to return it. Tosis points out over here, whoa, this is like a big Pandora's box, because you're opening up a subjective time frame to everybody. So Tosis says, no, that this time frame of Shira Tagar Lekovo is a standard objective time. That there is some sort of objective time which we give the individual that will, in most instances, will give him enough time to show it. If in his specific instance he can't show it, that's too bad, because that's the normal time frame which we give him. And if he had could have done it earlier, again, we give him that objective standard of time and don't make it subjective. Now, Horei Rabbi Tarfon Balud, Rabbi Tarfon Paskin and Lud, Ha'ona, Shmona Kesef, Misrim, Barba Kesef. He said that Ha'ona, overcharging, only kicks in when it's 8 out of 24. 8 out of 24 is 1/3. It's 2 times the amount of the 1/6. Meaning, he says, up until 1/3, that's not classified as Ona. Right, the seller, so that's Arba Kesef, seller, Shlish the Mekach, 1/3. The Samchut Tagarim Lud, the Tagarim, the merchants of Lud were all excited. Now, instead of being only up to charge up to a 6th, now they're able to charge up to a 3rd. Samar Lahem, he said to them, Kolam Mut, Yom Mutad Achzor. Retired and said, well, unlike the Chachamim who say that the cutoff, or when a transaction is locked in, is after the amount of time that you could have shown to an expert or relative, I say that they have the entire day to come to reverse the transaction. The buyer has a whole day not to be locked into the transaction. They say, all right, Rabbi Tarfon, we don't need your good, we don't need your bad. The Gemara will discuss exactly what the good and the bad were, but at this point, Rabbi Tarfon had expanded the amount of profit or the amount of excess they were allowed to charge without being in violation of Ona'a. Right, again, this we'll deal with tomorrow, but whether you hold like the Ramban and the Rush, whether it really is a violation of Ona'a, less than a 6th. But assuming that there is no violation of Ona'a, less than a 6th, then they could charge much more and not be in violation of Ona'a. On the other hand, they would rather have the transaction be locked in. So then the Chachamim, who gave a smaller window for the transaction to be locked in, they much preferred, even though they gave them a smaller quantity or overpayment amount. The Rabbi Tarfon says, look, you have up to a 3rd. But on the other hand, he says they can return it all day. And they said, No, thank you. Being able to return all day and not be able to finalize the transaction, we'd much rather have the transaction be finalized. That's what we're really after. So Itmar, the Gemara says, Rav Amar Shtut Mekach Shanino. When we're calculating Ona, the reference point or the context of which we calculated is the merchandise that is being sold here. The merchandise that is being sold is the determining factor for what we measure a sixth off of. So whatever that's worth, if you overpay by more than a sixth, or you underpay by more than a sixth, then there is Ona. Shmuel Amar Shtut Ma'ot Nami Shanino. Shmuel says that, no, we base it off of two things. We base it off both the merchandise and the money. We look at it from both perspectives. That means that if the anah is, meaning that if it's in excess of a sixth, then it's no good. So now Rav's position is that if it's in excess of a sixth above the merchandise price, then it's no good. Shmuel says, no, we look at both money and the merchandise. So if the merchandise, the overpayment is more than a sixth, but in the money that you overpaid, it's less than a sixth or it's a sixth, then we say that's still considered within the category of anah, it's still considered a sixth and not considered betel mekach or overpaying. So that's what Gemara says. Now explains this. Shava shita b'chamsho. If he sell something that's worth 6 for 5, right? Shava shita b'shiva. Or you sell something worth 6 for 7. Kuli amo lo pligi debata mecha chazlina. And there we go after the merchandise, because there the merchandise is worth 6. So in that case, if he overpays by a shekel, or if he underpays by a shekel, there is considered, it's still classified as onah. It's still classified within the 6th, and not overpayment beyond the 6th. But now, Havi, it's classified as onah, but not bitul mekach. On the other hand, ki pligay, when do they argue? Shavi chamsha b'shita. If they sell something that is worth 5 for 6 shekel, v'shavi shiva b'shita, or they sell something worth 7 for 6. The shmuel, damar batar ma'otas, lena, according to shmuel, that we also were after the money, idvi deonahavu. They're both still within the category of 1/6. Because even though the overpayment or the underpayment are more than a sixth of what the merchandise is worth, the merchandise is worth 5, and then you pay 6, you're paying overpaying by 20%. Nevertheless, in the context of the money, the 6 shekel that you paid, that overpayment is still only 1/6. So that 1/6 is classified still as onah. And the other way around too, with the 7 to 6, if the item was 7, then when you pay for the mekach, you only pay 6, then you're paying less than 1/6. Right? Nevertheless, Shmuel says no, because that is one shekel in reference to the money that you paid. The 6 that you paid is still classified as onah. The Rav, damar batar mekach hazlinan, shav, so there, according to Rav, it'll be different. Rav says that met only go after the mekach. Now, Shmuel says that we go after the merchandise, plus we go after the ma'ot. We go after both. We look at both of them in the context to determine the window or the parameters of what's considered onah. Otherwise, Rav says no, we only go after the mekach and not after the ma'ot. So therefore, Rav says in this case, if you sell something worth 5 for 6, then you paid over a sixth. Over a sixth, we nullify the transactions null and void, according to Rav. On the other hand, Shavi Shiva Bashita, if you sell something worth 7 for 6, then it's Mechilavi. It's less than a sixth, and then it's considered as if he's Mochel on the underpayment, or again, depending on whose perspective you're looking for, whether it's the discount that he gave or the underpayment that he made. Over there, he's Mochel on it because it's less than a sixth. So now, Ushmael Amar ki amrina mechila bitul mekach. When does we say mechila bitul mekach? When it's more than a sixth or less than a sixth, that's only heichi deleka shtut mishnei tzadidim. That means that it's more than a sixth, both from the monetary perspective and the merchandise perspective, or less than a sixth from the monetary perspective and the merchandise perspective. Heichi deleka shtut mitzad echad. In our case, what either it's a sixth of the money or it's a sixth of the mekach of the merchandise, onahavia. It's classified as onah. It's classified to be within the category of 1/6, and then it'll have the application the din of onah. And as we know in other places, the din of onah, which we're going to see in tomorrow's daf, din of onah is if you pay more than a sixth, then that transaction is null and void and can be reversed by either party. If you pay less than a sixth, there's mechila, and neither party has the right to reverse the transaction. If you pay exactly a sixth, we'll see this tomorrow, Rashi believes the transaction is locked in, that you cannot reverse the transaction, but you're entitled to collect the overpayment back. The Bein Otam says you have a choice. The individual who got cheated, or who got overcharged, or the one who lost out here, has a choice to pick. He can either nullify the entire transaction, or he can hold the transaction and get his onah refunded. So now what we've seen until now is just, we understood from what our Mishnah and from Rav and Shmuel, we understood that onah is machlokes b'din, or is a case between Rabbi Tarfon and Chachamim. The Chachamim believe it's a shtut, it's a sixth, and Rabbi Tarfon believed, or he paskin for the Tagdim, good. There was a third. They retired from besides passing as a third. Also extended the window for their return to the whole day versus just the amount of time that it could be shown to an expert. Then the Gemara discussed, how do you calculate this shtut? How do you calculate this 1/6 to determine the halacha that we just explained of more than a sixth and less than a sixth? How is that sixth calculated? Rav says it's solely about the merchandise, which makes the most sense. And it probably from the Mishnah makes sense because the Mishnah says the mekach, shlish the mekach, or shtut the mekach. So the simple interpretation and the easiest way to read the Gemara is like Rav and the Mishnah is like Rav, which is that it's all about the merchandise. The merchandise is the reference point and we just reference off the merchandise. Shmuel on the other hand says no, it's not just the merchandise, it's also the payment that's made. So we look at both of them and we look, there's a stretch or a gap in between what's below a sixth and above a sixth, because you have to look both at the money and at the merchandise. And anything that is a sixth or between those two amounts, meaning that it's above a sixth for one or below a sixth for the other, or a sixth of one and not a sixth of the other, that will be classified as onah, that middle category. Only if it exceeds a sixth on both the money and the merchandise, or if it's below a sixth for both merchandise and money, then we have the application of the other two halachot, which is either bitul mekach if it's above a sixth, or if it's below a sixth, that will be that there is mechila. Okay, we'll stop over here and we'll continue the sugya tomorrow.